On this edition of FedGov Today with Francis Rose, the Department of Veterans Affairs sprints toward AI success, an international approach to R&D for the Pentagon, and two key measures of the F-35 program going the wrong way. It's Wednesday, May 15th, 2024. Welcome to FedGov Today with Francis Rose. The FedGov Today podcast is going on the road next week to one of the biggest government industry collaborations of the year. ACT-IAC will host the Emerging Technology and Innovation Conference at the Hyatt Regency Chesapeake Bay in Cambridge, Maryland, starting this Sunday, May 19th through Tuesday, the 21st. The agenda is loaded with government superstars. You can read more about the lineup and sign up at fedgovtoday.com/events. And if you can't come to Cambridge, you'll hear from some of the speakers on the agenda on future editions of the FedGov Today podcast. A new artificial intelligence tech sprint is underway at the Department of Veterans Affairs. 152 teams are competing in the sprint on two tracks. Donna Hill is Deputy Director of Operations at the National Artificial Intelligence Institute at VA and Manager of the AI Tech Sprint. Donna, welcome. It's great to talk to you. The current Tech Sprint, I read, regards provider burnout. How do you choose the topics that you pursue during these Tech Sprints? Welcome, Donna.
Well, it depends on the source. We get sources, people give us information via email. You know, we have this problem. Can you help us? We crowdsource information sometimes. We have an AI VA community that information will come in on problems from that. In this particular case, this is a top priority for the Undersecretary of Health. He's very concerned for our healthcare workers. And with that, that's how this particular project was determined.
Dr. Elnahall talked to me about provider burnout and the concern that he has about it at HIMSS this year. That conversations in the archives at fedgovtoday.com. How do you go about, once you have the topic, how do you go about setting the parameters so that the teams know what it is you want them to try to accomplish on the sprints?
So for this particular tech sprint, we use challenge.gov. We created what we would the problem and what we need solved, and open the opportunity up for participants to register and begin to compete in this competition. So we lay it out in that particular documentation, and then they choose as to whether or not they feel like they can jump in and solve this problem.
How hands-on are you, and how do you screen them to determine whether these are people who can really work well on the problem at hand?
We have evaluation criteria that we develop. And we developed that with a group of cross-disciplinary experts based on the challenge itself. Of course, you know, the evaluation criteria for a training software would not be the same as a healthcare ambient dictation. So once we know what the problem is and what we're trying to solve, we work with a team of experts to create the evaluation criteria to ensure that we have equity across all of the participants who were coming in, and you know, consistency in the evaluation process itself.
What's the interaction with the teams during the sprint? Do you just kind of throw it over the fence and let the teams work with it? Or is there an ongoing interaction between the agency, you and your colleagues, and the teams that are working on these problems?
We have an ongoing interaction. We have weekly meetings. And in these weekly meetings, we provide them information on the VA itself, on the contracting process, on the issues that we're facing in the field, on ethics, trustworthy AI, you know, all of the things that we think could play into them being able to give us the best result. And we also have communications. We have an email box that they send us questions and we respond to those questions back to keep everybody on the same playing field. We then take those questions and we put them in a frequently asked questions log so that one person who was smart enough to ask a question doesn't get an advantage over the other people in the sprint. So we try to keep a level playing field, and we do our best to communicate. I will say that we were a little surprised at the sheer volume of participants for this particular sprint. So that communication became a little harder than it has been in the past where we've had smaller numbers. But we've done our best to ensure that they have what they need to move forward.
Do you have a sense of why the response was so great this time around and how all of those teams found out about the sprint to want to be involved with it to the extent that people want to be? I mentioned 152 teams. That does sound like a lot of interest and a lot of moving parts for administering this sprint.
We posted on challenge.gov. That posting, we also do some media in terms of we're putting this out on challenge.gov, take a look. So we'll put some things out on social media. We have a website. We make sure we put it out on our website. We do news releases that we've posted in challenge.gov. And then, you know, a lot of teams monitor challenge.gov. I mean, that's part of how they look for opportunities in the VA and in other government agencies. So between that and the news releases and things like that, this particular one drummed up a lot of interest. You asked me why so many people were interested. You know, all I can say is that this is a hot topic, not only for the VA, but for all healthcare systems in the United States. A lot of providers are struggling with burnout. And I think, you know, we're one of the largest healthcare systems in the U.S., and by my guess, I can't speak for the participants and why they signed up, but I'm sure that being able to show how well you can solve a problem at the VA would go a long ways for them, you know, in their organization, and potentially other areas.
I read from your website, which I'll link to in the show notes at fedgovtoday.com. The AI tech sprint has two areas of focus or tracks. I mentioned those at the beginning of our conversation, Donna. The track one AI tech sprint is ambient dictation for clinical encounter notes, and track two is community care document processing. Among the issue of provider burnout, What was the reason that you chose those two tracks specifically that you wanted these teams to try to help solve?
If you study provider burnout, people who are in the healthcare area who've been surveyed, about 52%, I think is the latest number I read, say it's administrative overload. There's the burnout is not caused by seeing the patients. It's caused about all the administrative duties that they have to do, often after hours, because they don't have time between patients to be able to accomplish all of these requirements. And, you know, doctors became doctors to care for patients. They didn't become doctors to do administrative work. And, you know, the second piece of it is they're on the computer all day long instead of being able to really sit and have a conversation. You've got them looking over a screen at a computer. And anybody who's gone to a doctor lately, I'm sure, experienced something very similar to that. So, you know, if we can reduce that administrative overhead and give them some productivity back in their day, or reduce the amount of overtime that they have to work, that's incredibly important and could go a long ways to trying to solve this problem. A veteran wants to see a provider who is not burnt out. You get the best care from a provider who is not burnt out. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we're trying to ensure that our veterans are getting the best care they can, and that our healthcare workers can work in an environment that is, you know, amenable to them having some work-life balance. So with all of that being said, part of the workload for providers is doing the patient summaries and the patient notes. It takes a lot of time to be able to do. And like I said, it often has to occur after hours. So if we can remove that burden from them, or make it at the very least quicker, where they're reviewing and submitting versus typing, then that helps alleviate some of that, you know, administrative overload. For the care in the community documents, you know, when a patient is seen in the community, often those records can be 300-400, you know, if you labs, x-rays, different documentation. Some are small, some maybe 20 pages, but some are huge. If they had a 3-day stay in a hospital, you could get 300-400 records on that. To ask the physicians to be able to review all of those records so that they know what happened when the patient comes in to have their visit is difficult. So, you know, I'm not sure that I could read 400 records in 20 minutes. I don't expect that many of our physicians could, you know, do that either. And so to get the best care for the veterans, again, if we have something that can read those records, summarize the pieces of that that's the highest priority, and put that up into a summary for the physicians, then, you know, when the patient shows up, the physician has that information at hand, and it's rather quick for them to scan through and realize, you know, what it is. Now, we are looking to index these records. And so if something comes up about the heart and the physician wants to see more, they should be able to click on that and it index to the original file and the original report of the heart. But it prevents the doctor from having to, you know, try to figure out how they're going to scan through this hundreds of pages of documentation. So if we can get these two things to work, then the administrative burden on the physician should decrease. That's our theory here, and we will be doing things to measure that as we go.
Another passage I read from the website is the top winners of the AI tech sprints receive prize money. Recognized prototypes may be invited to conduct a pilot of the product within VA or be introduced to another agency for next steps in product development. Given the stakes, how do you and your colleagues evaluate either during or at the end of the 3-month sprint who those winners are going to be and who gets a chance to kind of move on to the next round, if you will?
So we have evaluation criteria for each gate. We call them gates. So, you know, we have gate zero, which is evaluating the submissions that we received. Were the people, did their proposal answer the questions we asked them to answer? Does it look like it can solve the problems? And then we have, you know, the early gates are a little less competitive in terms of, you know, we might look at IT requirements. You know, do they really have a functioning solution that we can stand up within the VA? Are they able to meet privacy? We look at trustworthy AI. Is your solution delivering? Are you able to deliver the solution and follow the framework for trustworthy AI that the VA requires? So we have all of those kinds of things in the evaluation process as well. And then as we move forward, the evaluation criteria gets harder and harder and harder. Again, it's very specific to each sprint. So it's, you know, hard to say what the next sprint might be. But for these particular sprints, we had, you know, quantitative evaluations, we had qualitative evaluations, and we had clinician reviews. These reviews are done blind. So all the physicians see is a file number. And in this particular case, we also had physicians create notes, and we mixed it in with the AI notes. So that we could evaluate how the AI performed against the clinician. So we go through all of these different cycles. They're ranked and weighted based on rubrics. And, you know, we look at iterator reliability. We do all of those kinds of things. And then at the end of the day, they're scored. And then we have a cutoff for those scores, and that's how many gets to move forward. So it's a pretty thorough vetting process. And, you know, it is, again, we want to make sure we have consistency and equity across all of these evaluations, which is why that people don't know who they're evaluating. They don't know if they're evaluating physician or if they're evaluating the AI. So we're very careful about that.
Where are you in the timeline on this provider burnout sprint? And what does the timeline potentially look like for future sprints, Donna?
So we're in the last gate. Right now we're working with the finalist. We've executed the testing, so the evaluations are in process. We should know at some point here shortly who the winners will be. Now, that will be embargoed, of course. We will be announcing that on May 21st at the Golden the award ceremony the Golden Envelope Award Ceremony, I should say. And at that point, we'll announce the winners.
Donna, I wish you lots of success with the rest of the sprint, and I thank you very much for joining me to talk about it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You can read more about the AI tech sprint in today's show notes at fedgovtoday.com. I'm Francis Rose, the host of FedGov Today. The new episode of Innovation in Government from Sea Air Space is available on demand now. Leaders from the Office of Naval Intelligence, Naval Information Warfare, Atlantic, the Marine Corps, and the Coast Guard, plus industry, will tell you how the sea services are taking on data, cyber, and AI challenges. You can watch Innovation in Government from Sea Air Space anytime you want on FedGovToday.com and on the FedGov Today YouTube channel. The Defense Department's working with five international partners to co-fund research and development projects. That work is happening in the Irregular Warfare Technical Support Directorate. Roger Newberry is director of the directorate. On the latest edition of FedGov Today TV from Soft Week in Tampa, he tells me how those relationships work.
We've got unique memorandums with five countries, Canada, Australia, the UK, Singapore, and Israel. They're research and development MOUs, so we can do research and development projects co-funded between the countries and ourselves. They're bilateral, and it has to be mutually beneficial technology, so it should benefit all each partner. There are some projects we try and we may end up with three partners signed in, but we have to have legally where each partner is contributing to a separate part of the whole, but they'll all get the whole when it's completed. They're unique in the department. Normally, a department working with foreign partners, international allies, do project agreements. They take often a year and a half to 2 years to come to fruition. Our MOUs can take a year plus to develop. But once they're developed, all our projects are under what we call task plans. So the task plans are non-binding, signed by my counterpart and myself and the project managers. And we can do a task plan agreement with a foreign partner in sometimes as little as a week or two, normally maybe 4 to 6 weeks. And we're off and running. So a lot of other Department of Defense people, organization would come in and ask for us to do task plans to develop projects that are beneficial to the defense agency or our military users. We have to be careful if there's already project agreements in play. What we can do is help the service or the organization jumpstart it. In other words, while they're taking a year or two to finalize project agreement, we can jumpstart it so the work can start now. Like I said, it's unique in the department. Nobody has that except our organization. There's several countries that want to join in as well. The workload's heavy. We have about in IWTSD, we're doing about 253 projects annually. 179 of those projects have international partners tied to them. So they've contributed either with money or subject matter expertise or something they've already been developing. But the workload is heavy, and we meet with each international partner in a large bilateral meeting twice a year. So they'll host in their country once, and 6 months later we'll host in our country, and we'll rotate that. Well, you can imagine five partners twice a year, that's 10 meetings a year that we have to put together, yes, in addition to all the rest of the work we're doing. So other countries coming in, a few I won't mention, but that would bring the number up 6, 7, and four. We would have to look at maybe tailoring our work where the other country is most interested in or where we think we can get the most benefit from and not necessarily meet twice a year with every country. Yeah.
I want to ask you about the technologies. You said you're working on mutually beneficial technology. Do most of those ideas come from the United States? Do most of those ideas come from partners and the United States realizes the benefits of them? What does that kind of breakdown look like?
It depends on the technology. Singapore is really big on advanced analytics, IT type technology. Israel, across the board, they're a heavy technology organization. The UK is probably the next, where we're involved with them a lot. Then Canada, a lot in chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear explosive detection and identification. We have a really strong partnership now with them as in the last 2 to 3 years in tactical offensive support. So weapons technology, loitering munitions, that type of thing. drone, lethal drones, robotics. Australia also, kind of a smaller partnership. A lot of it is involved how much money they have to invest. I would say a lot of it is U.S. technology driven, and then they want to buy into it. With Israel, it's their technology, and they do a lot of good technology because they've been fighting for decades. So we benefit from them. What we've done with them now is encourage them and more to develop manufacturing in the U.S. So their companies may have the development, if it's weapons or certain things, we have to make it, we have to Americanize it. Our warheads, safety, meet all our safety parameters and stuff. And then what we want to do is have manufacturing set up in the U.S.
We just have a couple of minutes left. When you get something that everybody likes and that you want to move forward, what are some of the challenges that you've run into in moving something from prototype to production?
There's what's called the Valley of Death.
Talk about that a lot on this.
So a lot of the services and working with SOCOM, they have to work a five-year budget plan. But when you come up with new technology that somebody wants, they haven't developed that five-year plan, and so it's a gap. And we have to either continue funding it, or we have to find a way where they can buy a small number. We'll put things on a DLA catalog, GSA catalog, and stuff. We buy lots of prototypes so we can have lots of users try them, and we train them so they know what they're doing. And really, the marketing is from the ground up, not from the top down. So there is that part of getting requirements or capability gaps from the bottom and matching that with what the headquarters thinks the capability gaps are. And so making that that tie is important. And we work with small businesses, so having them transition and be able to partner with manufacturing companies where they can actually produce and sell at an affordable cost, because that's the other thing we want, rapid and affordable cost.
Roger Newberry of DOD's Irregular Warfare Technical Support Directorate on FedGov Today TV this week. You can find links to watch that show on demand in today's show notes at fedgovtoday.com. Two of the F-35 program's key metrics are how much the planes cost and how much the services can use them. According to new data from the Government Accountability Office, both of those metrics are trending in the wrong direction. Diana Maurer is Director of Defense Capabilities and Management at GAO. At agency headquarters recently, she told me what she and her team found when they looked at both markers.
Well, you would hope that over time, availability would be trending up. And we've issued reports in the past that have talked about low numbers on mission capable rates and other metrics. Unfortunately, what we found in our most recent report is that availability is actually moving in the wrong direction, that mission capable rates across the entire fleet have been declining for the past few years. And on average, the fleet is able to fly one of its missions in the high 50 percentage points across the whole fleet.
What was the original goal of the department regarding availability? And how does that 50% rate compare to what the department thought they were going to get out of this?
So it varies across variant of the F-35, but broadly speaking, it's in the 70 to 80% range. So that's pretty far from what the services more specifically want to see from the F-35 fleet.
What has driven that? We'll start with the availability piece, how they got here, not to focus on the negative, but to try to understand what has to change. And obviously, we'll get to recommendations later in the conversation. But how did they get to where they are regarding the availability, Diana?
So we've identified a number of challenges that are a drag on availability. Not enough spare parts. So typically about 20%, sometimes more, of the fleet is grounded for lack of spare parts. The depot repair infrastructure, which is the portion of repair of the most sophisticated pieces and systems on the F-35, was underdeveloped for many, many years. So the services and the Joint Program Office built up a ginormous backlog of major components waiting to be repaired. That was also a drag on readiness. And there are other challenges as well. The intellectual property for the F-35 is by and large controlled by the prime contractor. That has created challenges for the flight line maintainers and the services to do what they need to do to maintain the aircraft, and we definitely heard an earful from them about what they said they'd be capable of doing if the services had more access to the intellectual property.
How much of that goes all the way back to the original procurement process, though? I imagine that piece of it especially is involved in the way that the department originally agreed to buy the aircraft, what, 15, 20 years ago now?
Yeah, we're talking about decisions that are 20-plus years old at this point, and you're absolutely right. That approach to intellectual property was baked into the DNA from the of the program from day one, this concept that the contractor was going to be the leading force responsible for sustainment. That was also built into the DNA. Fast forward to now, there's a broad recognition at OSD and the services that the Defense Department needs to gain additional control over sustainment. And the department and the services are working to develop strategies to do that.
Sidebar, and not necessarily pertaining to the F-35 in particular, but generally to the work that you do in this area, because you do all kinds of work in this area, is the department getting their arms around that IP issue, and what is the overall level of cooperation in the vendor community to respond to that desire on the part of the department? Is that a trending in the right direction in your view?
I think there's been a lot of progress made over the last couple of years, but there are systems, the F-35 is really the poster child for this, where IP decisions made 10, 15, 20 years ago are baked into the program. Mm-hmm. So it can be very difficult and very costly for the government to try to change the terms of the agreement on intellectual property. As DoD is developing new systems, they're more in tune about making sure that they don't have what's known as vendor lock mm-hmm. 20 years down the road, where they're really beholden to an extensive degree on contractor having control over intellectual property, which has implications for logistics, sustainment, and other things.
And that's more what I was getting at with that question, because otherwise we wind up 15 years from now back in the same spot that we're in today. And so that's more of a lessons learned question than anything. Same thing then as far as the cost increases. I read sustainment cost estimates have increased 44% from about $1.1 trillion in 2018 to about $1.58 trillion in 2023. That's only a five – my math isn't so great. That's a five-year window for cost to increase at that rate. That strikes me as rather high. Is that a fair read on my part?
That is a very significant increase in lifecycle sustainment costs. And when you include the $450 billion that they're spending to develop and produce the aircraft, total lifecycle costs are north of $2 trillion at this point. One of the main drivers for that increase was that from 2018 to 2023, DoD made the decision to fly the aircraft or plan to fly the aircraft for 11 additional years. So that's a big piece, a big part of why those numbers have increased for sustainment costs. They also took, frankly, a more realistic look at inflation, both actual inflation as well as projected inflation, and that's been a driver as well. So we definitely want to reflect that. But big picture, DoD has been working for 10, 15 years plus trying to bring down sustainment costs. And what we've seen over time is those sustainment costs continue to go up and up and up.
So it strikes me there are two issues as far as the costs go. One is the actual costs themselves, which you've just outlined. And another is something that you address in this work, which is how the department estimates what those costs are going to be in the future. What's the intersection of those two things? And where is the department really struggling in the estimates area to try to get their arms around what this will, what the actual dollars will be in the future? Because it strikes me when you're talking about a program that's going to be in play until 2088, that's a really tough game to try to play.
That's a very tough game to play. And so what DoD does internally is that usually annually, the program, the F-35 program office, develops an annual cost estimate. And then the cost estimation group within OSD develops an independent cost estimate. And one of the things that we did in our review was kind of put those side by side. And they were in the same ballpark. And that's been the case for the last few years. So from an estimation perspective, they're reasonably on target, given the vast uncertainties in trying to project costs 60 years into the future.
All right. Here's the good news, some of the good news that I took out of this work. The military services, you and your team write, have made progress meeting their affordability targets largely because of two factors: reducing the amount of time the services estimate they'll fly the aircraft each year, and increasing the Air Force's affordability target. Talk about the second one first. What are the factors that have contributed to the Air Force being able to change its affordability target?
Right. So when we reported on this last 3 years ago, at that time, the Air Force said it could afford to spend a little over $4 million per F-35A per year. We reported there was a vast gap between what they planned to spend and what it was actually going to cost. The Air Force went back, took a look at its budget numbers, and said, no, we can actually afford to spend $6.8 million per aircraft per year. That's a significant increase, and it was really incumbent on the Air Force to change its prioritization of future spending and out years. The other thing they did, like the other services, and we'll get to this, I'm sure, in a second, is they decreased the number of annual flight hours it planned to fly the F-35A. They cut it by about 14 or 15%. The combination of those two things closed that affordability gap. It reduced the projected amount to cost to fly the plane, and it increased the amount the Air Force is willing to spend or planning to spend.
Is there a metric that indicates, though, whether then they get the end results that they want out of the program? Because they're saving money, yes, or maybe being more realistic about the money that they have to spend. But I imagine with a reduced number of flying hours, you have less pilot rep time to get repetitions to become familiar with the aircraft and become an expert at flying the aircraft. I'm aware of the level of sophistication in the cockpit of the plane. It's not an easy plane to fly. It's not an easy plane to learn to fly, and so on. So I wonder if there's any way to apply a productivity metric, mm-hmm. I guess, for lack of a better term, to understand, yeah, we're doing these things that we have these metrics for, but are we then getting the maximum potential out of the program that we're getting?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I know that that's something that the Air Force and, frankly, all the aviation services build into those flight hour estimates. We didn't try to get behind those numbers as part of this review, but that's a great issue for us to maybe look into in the future.
I'm sorry to make more work for you.
No, happy to do
it. In that respect, Diana. You note that there are several ways that the department is working to cut sustainment costs on this aircraft. What are they, and what progress do you see in the department working on those things, Diana?
So going back, almost well over 10 years, maybe as far back as 15 years, the Joint Program Office for the F-35 has had a number of initiatives. There was the Cost War Room, then there was the War on Cost. They've had other initiatives, and that was in a way to sort of shrink the amount of cost going into sustainment. Those efforts have yielded some savings, but they really haven't moved the needle. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, this is a $2 trillion life cycle expense. So if you could squeeze a $20 million cost savings, that's not insubstantial. I'd be happy to take $20 million, but that's really kind of a rounding error. And that's kind of where they've been so far on the outcomes of those kinds of initiatives.
And I guess the availability is kind of the reverse of that. They've taken efforts to try to cut the costs, but they've also they've been forced by that effort, it sounds like, from the way that you've described it and from what I read here, that the reduction in availability and flying hours is kind of a byproduct of that. Well, okay, if we're going to save this kind of money, we have to fly the aircraft less.
Exactly. I mean, just to use one example, we'll talk about the Navy. So for their variant of the F-35, they've showed an annual reduction in cost per aircraft per year of about 41%, which is pretty remarkable. But they did that by reducing the number of flight hours by 44%. So it was just largely flying it less, had nothing to do with making the overall sustainment enterprise more efficient.
And I guess, as I mentioned, I don't do math too well, but it strikes me if you cut the cost by 41%, but you cut the availability by 44%, I don't know that you really came out ahead.
Not so much, no. Not in the big picture.
All right. What are the services and what is DOD doing overall not enough of or not doing in order to achieve the end goals, which is, I imagine, to get the aircraft in the air more and less expensively?
Sure. So we have a number of open recommendations around the overall sustainment enterprise. One that dates back to 2014 is for the program to take a hard look at its overall strategy for intellectual property. They have not closed that recommendation yet. That, I think that's vitally important for sustainment and other aspects of the program. We have open recommendations around the global supply chain. This is an international program with a common set of spare parts and a common sustainment enterprise and depot repair facilities and so forth. We have specific recommendations around better management of that overall global system. And we think that the services and DOD need to take a hard look at a major change that's coming in the program. 3 years down the road, the services are going to have the lead responsibility for making sustainment management decisions. It will no longer be the Joint Program Office, which means Department of Navy and the Department of Air Force will have lead responsibility in calling the shots. And so they need to be ready to do that. They're still working through those details, and we issued a report back in September that kind of prodded the DOD establishment to start accelerating the ability to make decisions on that. And there are a lot of folks, particularly in OSD, who are working very hard to get there, but it's a major challenge.
Diana Maurer of GAO, you can find a link to the work Diana talked about in today's show notes at fedgovtoday.com. I know you're really busy and you might not catch all the podcasts and TV shows FedGov Today has to offer. If you want to keep up with everything that we're putting out, you can follow us on LinkedIn to get the latest updates. I'm Francis Rose. I'll see you on FedGov Today TV this Sunday morning at 10:30 on ABC7 in Washington and simulcast on our YouTube channel. You'll get the next FedGov Today podcast next Wednesday. Until then, thanks very much for listening.